90 days, or within 90 days. The next case on the calendar is State of Minnesota versus William Dumont White. It's A19-0307. I see counsel in the courtroom. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Michael McLaughlin. I'm an attorney from the State Public Defender's Office. And I'm here representing the appellant, William White, on this case. This case presents three main issues that we address in the brief. First, that the evidence was legally insufficient to support the conviction for unlawful possession of a firearm, that the gun should have been suppressed by the district court, and also that Mr. White's sentence was excessive. I'd like to first turn to the sufficiency argument and then address the other two issues. The evidence against Mr. White rested primarily on the fact that he was a prior passenger in the car where a gun was found in the glove compartment. The parties agree that this is a circumstantial evidence case and that the circumstantial evidence standard applies. There's no direct evidence that Mr. White possessed the gun. No one saw him in possession. Even the driver who sat directly next to him in the car never observed him in possession of the gun. So we're dealing with the circumstantial evidence test. And under that standard, court, you know, looks at all of the facts that were established at trial and determines whether those circumstances complete chain that leads directly to the defendant's guilt and that excludes all other reasonable inferences of innocence.
If the driver's testimony is accepted as true, that is that it isn't her gun, that she has a key to the car and no one else, and there wasn't a gun there the last time she checked before Mr. White was in the car, doesn't that eliminate all reasonable inferences other than that Mr. White put it there?
Well, that testimony does address, we agree, it addresses the other inferences. But the circumstantial evidence test also requires the first aspect of it, that there's those circumstances establish a direct connection between the defendant and in this case, for this crime, the gun. So our position is even if the court accepts the driver's testimony as established at trial and doesn't agree with our analysis regarding that she was an accomplice, even under that case, there is still no direct evidence tying Mr. White to the gun. All that is here is that he was a temporary passenger in the vehicle.
Well, Lord knows I get wound around the axle about circumstantial evidence from time to time, but this one does seem like if you accept her testimony as true, there's no other alternative. There's no testimony that there was another person who had access to it during that period of time.
In the reply brief, We try to make this argument, but it's our position that the circumstantial evidence standard is a higher level of scrutiny than exists under the regular standard. And under the regular standard, the state bears the burden of proof, and guilt cannot be established by an absence of proof. And to look only at the circumstances that the driver testifies to regarding other people who possibly put the gun in the car, but not to require any evidence connecting Mr. White to that gun, would, in effect, shift the burden and result in a standard that's lower than the typical legal sufficiency standard. In all the cases, for instance, in Sam, this court noted that there was no direct evidence tying, or there's no evidence of any kind establishing a direct tie between the defendant and...
It doesn't have to be direct evidence.
No, I misspoke. But there's no, in Sam, it spoke that there was no evidence establishing, no circumstantial evidence establishing a direct tie between the defendant and the drugs found in the car. The same here, there are no facts, no circumstances showing that Mr. White in particular was the possessor of the gun. beyond his mere presence in the vehicle. And this court and the Supreme Court has held that the mere presence of someone in a vehicle cannot establish...
Well, not just presence, but proximity to the gun.
Right.
He's the passenger. This is found in the glove compartment right in front of the passenger seat, right?
That's,
so it's
that's
not
correct.
Just being present in the car. It's the proximity to this firearm.
That's correct. And he was... within the vehicle, he was proximate to where the gun was located in the vehicle. But even that being so, a defendant's proximity by itself is not enough to establish possession, especially where the individual is not the driver of the vehicle, so there's no basis to infer custody and control from the status of being in control of the vehicle. The majority of the evidence at trial dealt with the driver's testimony regarding other people who could have put the gun in the car. But the only evidence regarding Mr. White were really two sets of facts. First, that he was present in the vehicle, and second, that he entered the vehicle and the driver did not observe him in possession of a gun when he entered. Those were the only facts directly bearing on Mr. White's possession in particular.
I want to understand your argument that accomplice testimony has to be corroborated. And you're not calling the driver of the car an alternate perpetrator. You're calling her an accomplice.
Yes, that's correct.
Your client was charged with an ineligible person in possession of a firearm, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is there any testimony or evidence in the record that the driver was an ineligible person?
No, there's not. So,
was there any testimony that the driver knew that Mr. White was not eligible?
There's no testimony at trial.
You get to accomplice then.
So our position is the relevant crime in a broader sense is unlawful possession of a firearm. In two separate statutes, the legislators set up a gross misdemeanor level of offense for unlawful possession and a felony level. First, so the evidence at least establishes that under the operation of the statute that there's a reasonable inference that a driver is in custody and control of a weapon found in the car. Under that statute...
The legislature has made a class of people really ineligible if they've committed a crime of violence or have a felony,
right?
Right.
Yes, sir.
And that's why your client was ineligible, because he was that class of
people. Right.
The driver, we don't know anything about her. There's no evidence that she has any criminal record.
Right.
For all we know, she could be a licensed person to carry.
Well, that fact wasn't addressed at trial. So
right, but we don't know one way or the other.
That's
just saying that I have a handgun in my car, you don't know if that's illegal or not, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, yes.
I don't, by the way.
You do in your chambers.
But I would be licensed to if I wanted to.
Our argument is the complaint and so would support, and then there's no evidence that she was to have a firearm license. So it could support a charge of gross misdemeanor. And Mr. White's felony conviction as a consequence of being an ineligible person based on a commission of a prior violent felony, an individual cannot be licensed to possess a firearm.
You said that there's a reasonable inference that the driver, the owner, has control over what's in the vehicle. There's also a reasonable inference that if you're in close proximity to a firearm in an automobile, that you're in constructive possession. Isn't that true?
There isn't a similar statute that states that. And
we even forget the statute. We talk
right.
about inferences. Circumstantial evidence, that's still there, isn't it?
It's an inference, but this court's held that that's not an inference that is sufficient to support guilt. A passenger's presence in proximity to either a gun or drugs found in a car is not legally sufficient to establish guilt. And the court held that in Sam, and the Supreme Court held that in Harris. So that's not enough. So an additional argument regarding sufficiency, and then I should move on to the suppression. But The state here is asserting constructive possession. Under Florine, the test for constructive possession is whether the defendant exercised custody and control and dominion over the weapon at the time of the arrest. At the time of Mr. White's arrest, he'd already left the car. The driver of the car had authority to exclude him from the vehicle, so he did not continue to exercise dominion and control over the weapon at the time.
Did anybody exercise dominion or control over this vehicle after it stopped? Was the driver, did the driver stay with the vehicle?
The driver briefly left the vehicle but then returned by the time of the stop. So at the time of the police stop, the driver was in the vehicle.
And she consented to the search, right?
She did, yes. Yep. So it's our position that even if the driver's testimony is accepted, there's still not sufficient evidence for constructive possession here because Mr. White did not exercise dominion control at the time of his arrest.
On your expansion of the stop argument, the state argues that you abandoned or didn't pursue the suppression arguments below and instead have new ones on appeal, and that you can't raise constitutional issues for the first time on appeal. Could you address that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. So it's our position that, the argument we raise here in our brief is that the source of Mr. White's Fourth Amendment interest in this case and what gives him standing to make this argument is that he was seized at the time of the search, and that the search was an unlawful expansion of that seizure. And the authority we rely on for that proposition is Miller, a case this court decided in 2003. And in Miller, the state raised a similar argument that a passenger of a vehicle could not challenge a dog sniff of the vehicle because the passenger didn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the vehicle. This court declined to accept the state's reasonable expectation of privacy analysis and instead said that a person who is seized and who challenges a search occurring after that seizure as beyond the initial justification for the seizure has standing to make that challenge. So the Miller case rooted the standing interest and the Fourth Amendment interest in the seizure, not in the reasonable expectation of privacy. Defense counsel below expressly relied on Miller and then two unpublished cases that this court decided that applied Miller. Defense counsel didn't articulate the argument in exactly the same way, but the relevant holding of Miller established that the standing comes from the seizure and not the reasonable expectation of privacy. So it's our position that her, by expressly relying on Miller, was sufficiently raised the issue before the district court.
Time's wasting or running out here. I know it's not wasting. I'd like to turn to the sentencing questions. Do you want to use your remaining time to talk about that?
Sure, Your Honor. So here Mr. White received the statutory maximum 180-month sentence. The presumptive for his crime, even with his criminal history score, was 60 months, with the top of the box being 71 months. It's our position that sentence was disproportionate to what other individuals have received for similar crimes and in similar circumstances. In only 1% of all felon in possession cases have defendants received during a period of 2013 to 2017. Only 1% of cases have defendants received aggravated sentences of any kind. Even among individuals with a criminal history score of 6 or higher, as Mr. White had, it's only in 2% of cases have individuals received an aggravated sentence. So for the court to go not just to depart, but to go all the way up to the statutory maximum in this case, we believe results in an excessive sentence. Also would note that this crime itself, there's nothing about the facts of this crime that justify going above that sentence, that presumptive sentence. First, in terms of Mr. White's criminal history.
Of course, the reason for departure wasn't the facts of the crime itself. The reason for departure was his criminal history.
That's true. I agree with that, Your Honor. But the I mean, this court's, the proportionality analysis, though, compares the culpability to punishment. So even though that the basis for departure didn't rest in the nature of the crime was committed, when this court is looking at whether a sentence is excessive, it conducts a comparison between culpability and the punishment. And here they're just the punishment exceeded the culpability. But also would just note that the Supreme Court has cautioned that when applying the career violent offender statute, a court should use caution because an individual's criminal history is already addressed on the grid and in the criminal history score. So given all those facts, this was an excessive sentence. The highest, of course, ever gone is 105 months for this crime during 2013 to 2017. And this court, or the district court, exceeded that by 75 months.
So your argument is really that it's such an outlier that we ought to reverse it?
Yes, reduce it to the presumptive 60-month sentence, be our request. All right, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota, in this case. I intended to cover some of the issues that were raised in the reply brief, but most of those, I believe, have been addressed by questions of the court. One that was not was an argument made that the neighbor could have been charged under 609.713 under a different subdivision because the officer smelled marijuana in the motor vehicle.
You say neighbor, do you mean driver?
The driver, I'm sorry, yes, JV. But if you look at the statute, possession of marijuana is only unlawful under 152.027 subdivision 3, which covers possession of marijuana in a motor vehicle. It's a misdemeanor only if the driver possesses on the person or knowingly keeps or allows to be kept within the area of the vehicle normally occupied by the driver and passengers more than 1.4 grams of marijuana. The vehicle was searched, no marijuana was found in the car. So if it's just a small amount of marijuana, it's a petty misdemeanor, it's a non-criminal act, therefore it's not unlawful, which is the portion of the statute that appellant cited to. So even if you were to accept that bringing JV into 609.714 as opposed to 713 as opposed to 609.714 somehow makes this, changes the analysis. It doesn't. I think the standards of review here really decide the case.
Please address Judge Rodenberg's question about how long the sentence is compared to every other sentence for this crime.
Well, just on the bare facts that we have, yes. But as I note in my brief, if you're going to compare a sentence in one case to sentence in other cases, there needs to be some context. We have absolutely no context about what these other cases were. We have no idea.
Context is there's no case that reaches this limit.
That's true. That's true. But the district court, the issue is whether the district court abused its discretion. And the district court in the sentencing, I quote a portion of it, but actually there's quite a bit of discussion in the sentencing hearing. The district court lays out the reasons why it's giving the statutory max. She comes to the conclusion that appellant is a dangerous person and warrants the maximum sentence. Multiple
separate out the fact that a lot of that dangerousness was already subsumed in the criminal history. Don't they have a problem of double consideration?
Well, there are other factors that were presented to the court. The fact that appellant had been in prison before and he had been on probation before, yet he continues to commit crimes. based on the testimony that appellant himself gave at the sentencing hearing, he's minimizing all the criminal conduct. He minimized the domestic assault convictions. Look, I didn't beat her brains in, or I didn't beat her head in. You can get a disorderly conduct just for yelling nowadays. He showed absolutely no insight to any of the crimes that he had previously committed, and the district court noted that he seemed to blame everyone for everything that had ever happened to him, and just didn't feel that probation was appropriate for him and that it warranted.
Offender or offense characteristic?
Pardon me?
Is this an offender or offense characteristic?
Well, that would be an offender characteristic. It's how does the offender present himself or herself to the court?
Offender characteristics support this kind of departure?
Well, the district court clearly believed that it did.
That's not my question. I mean, we've historically distinguished between offender and offense characteristics, have we not?
Yes.
And offender characteristics can support this kind of lengthy sentence?
Well, the sentence is supported under 609.1095. That's the basis for the departure. Is this a sentence that is out of the norm? I'm not going to argue that it's not. I can't argue that it's not. The issue, though, is whether or not the district court abused its discretion when it imposed this sentence. If the court feels that the district court abused its discretion, then the court can remand it. Appellant counsel asked that this court reverse the sentence and impose.
I may have misstated that myself.
I believe the proper thing then would be to remand it to the district court.
For resentencing within whatever parameters we would suggest are appropriate.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I'm not going to argue that this isn't a unique sentence. It is. If there are no other questions, I will cede my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. McLaughlin?
Thank you. First, with regard to the sentence, we would note that, I mean, the state pointed to the fact of Mr. White's criminal history and that his statements he made at sentencing didn't show that he made sense, is that he minimized that criminal history. I guess our point would be, whatever frame you look at this sentence, it still is excessive, even among individuals who have an extensive criminal history, at least to a score of 6 or higher. This still is an extreme outlier sentence, and that the facts that the state offers to distinguish this as an unusual case that warrants a maximum sentence just exist whenever there's a high criminal history score. So we'd ask that shouldn't be a legitimate basis to support the sentence that was imposed here. With regard to the suppression argument, it's significant that the state here made no argument that the police stop in this case was lawful. There's no dispute that they seized the individual's car. There's really no dispute that they lacked reasonable suspicion when they conducted that seizure. The only question is whether Mr. White, in this criminal prosecution, had a Fourth Amendment interest to challenge that police action. And what we're asking for is just the court to adopt a rule that if the police have decided that they want to seize someone, and if they decide to hold someone while conducting a further investigation into that individual to see if there's any further criminal activity, to the extent that the police lack a lawful basis for that investigative activity, the seized individual should have a Fourth Amendment interest that he can use to challenge that
action. Who are you talking about here, White or his son?
We're talking about White. I mean, well, and I agree. I understand your point, Your Honor. The police were generally, the report suggests they were generally looking for evidence relating to the shooting in that car, and that was really the basis for the stop, the true basis for the stop. But those statements also show that the police were aware of Mr. White's criminal history, and that.
Well, what's the stop on the appellant?
Where
was the stop?
The stop was when he was arrested. I mean, it was when he was arrested for disorderly conduct. That's the seizure. And it's our position that they.
You're saying there was no probable cause for that?
We did, yes. We argue that there's no probable cause for the initial seizure, and then they were limited in the scope of that seizure to.
Probable cause for disorderly conduct?
There's no probable cause. Well, there was no lawful basis under the rules to arrest him because.
Your argument is they should have issued him a citation and sent him on his way.
Right.
But what, you know, okay, Judge Riley and I are in the car. She's driving. Police stopped.
Why'd you left me out of the car?
You're not involved. Police stopped the car because they're investigating a crime, and I get out and I get arrested for whatever reason. They come back to her. They're still investigating the crime. They were mistaken. I understand. They sort of had a misunderstanding of what had happened. But they say to Judge Riley, "Can we search your car?" And she says, "Yes." What's my complaint about her consent to the police asking them to search her car?
Well, if the police had a lawful basis in relation to Judge Riley, they would have an independent basis to justify it. So I don't think you could do that. But if the only reason they asked Judge Riley to search the car is to find evidence on you, it's our position that you have your Fourth Amendment interest provides that if they arrest you, their conduct has to be limited to the scope of that arrest. They
Here
can't
they had
conduct open-ended
smell
searches.
Of marijuana in the car. Does that give them enough basis to ask her to search the car? And she says yes?
It would. But we'd note in this case, they didn't smell the marijuana until the stop had started. So that what we're challenging is the initial seizure, and that occurred before any marijuana was smelled by the officers, and that there was no reasonable suspicion to support that initial seizure. And the purpose of that seizure was to sort of conduct a fishing expedition, but an open-ended inquiry into whether there might be something connected to the shooting in the car. And they had concerns that either Mr. White or his son had some involvement in the shooting, but they didn't have any evidence to substantiate that concern. And that's why they looked in the car. And Mr. White should have a Fourth Amendment interest that allows him to challenge the legality of that conduct when the conduct is targeted at finding evidence on him and he's already
seized. He abandoned the car here, didn't he? He got out of the car and walked away.
Yep, he did.
So did he abandon his claim of expectation of privacy in that car?
We don't focus our argument on expectation of privacy. Our position is that the seizure is where the Fourth Amendment interest comes from. So he may not have had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the car, but he still had a Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable seizures, and the seizure became unreasonable when the police held him to sort of conduct this open-ended investigation.
Can I ask mm-hmm. one more question? With respect to the seizure of Mr. White away from the car for disorderly conduct, I agree with you that the rules sort of presumptively expect that officers will issue a citation in that circumstance. Are you asking us to hold in a published opinion that police may never detain an individual who they believe has committed disorderly conduct in their presence?
No, we're not asking for that rule, no. And again, and even if the court finds that there was a lawful basis for that seizure, it's still our position that they exceeded the scope of the seizure.
That part I understand.
There were specific findings that he wasn't that the police it wasn't the police reports that they didn't feel that their safety was in danger. There was also no affirmative evidence that he was a flight risk or that there was an ongoing crime. So, or that he would commit an ongoing crime if he wasn't arrested. So it's our argument that none of the criteria for a arrest for this type of offense were met in this case.
Thank you. The case is submitted and we'll have our decision out within the statutory time period. The next case is A19-0718 ARF versus Creekside, and we're gonna have a swap out of judges. So I see the attorneys are here. If you'd come forward, please. Mr. White's family came from St. Cloud.